This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is A Courageous Brain, Not Manipulated by Needless Fear, with Dr. Rick Hansen, acclaimed neuropsychologist and best-selling author. His most recent book is Hardwiring Happiness, The New Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. And now I'm delighted to introduce you to Dr. Hansen, who will begin our program. Thank you, Dr. Hansen.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here, truly. I'll stay seated. I apologize for that part, just for the sake of the microphone and the rest of that. Feel free to move around to participate better. Our plan for the evening is that I'll present for hopefully not too long, you know, a dozen or so minutes, maybe a little longer. And then we really invite you to share your questions or comments with us. And then Ann and I will try to respond to them, and then we'll wrap up right on time. So if there is a question or comment that you have along the way, I believe the procedure is to write it out, and then we'll collect them, and Ann will guide us with regard to them, and we'll do the best we can. All right.
If you look by close by in your seats, you will find, and I'm sorry I didn't tell you this earlier, a question card. And what will happen is we'll come up and down and collect the cards. We do have pencils if you need them.
Great. So I came here tonight to speak to a general theme under the heading of courage, having heart, taking heart, finding heart, sharing heart, under all conditions. And then something happened a couple days ago. It was an election. And so that is certainly in the minds and hearts, I think, of many of us, certainly me included. With regard to that, just sort of a framing comment, people have many, many different reactions to the same event. And it's not my place here to indicate what I think is the right reaction to anything, or even to speak to the level of public policy. I have my personal opinions about that, which I'll try to keep to myself, and open into a larger frame, which is, there's a classic model, you may know it already, in healthcare and medicine and psychology. It has a fancy name, the stress diathesis model. It's a simple framework. It basically says the course of anybody over a day or a month or a lifetime is really the result of three kinds of factors, three kinds of causes: challenges, vulnerabilities, and resources. Challenges wear on vulnerabilities, and we manage challenges and protect vulnerabilities with resources. And of those three factors, kinds of factors, and you could think of them in your own life, challenges, vulnerabilities, resources, I categorize them in three locations loosely: out in the world, in the body, in the mind. Okay? Loosely. And I'm going to focus tonight on building up resources in the mind. Sometimes people frame it as either or, you know, that, oh, you should deal with challenges, not try to grow resources, or you should grow resources rather than deal with challenges, or you should intervene in the world instead of the mind, or you should intervene in the mind instead of the world. I came to awareness of society in the early 60s. Often there's this sort of false dichotomy between the personal and the political. I don't think it's either or. You intervene where you can with what you can. You do the best you can. I think about a quotation from the life of Nkosi Johnson. Nkosi Johnson said this. He was a boy born in South Africa with HIV. He died when he was about 12 years old, I think roughly a decade or so ago, after becoming an advocate for people with HIV/AIDS in South Africa, particularly children. And to closely paraphrase something he said that has touched my heart many, many times since, he says, "Do all that you can with what you've been given, in the place where you are, in the time that you have." And I think if that 12-year-old kid can say words like that, that give me the shivers right now and touch me personally right now, the least I can do myself is to try to aspire to what he has said. So it's in that larger context then that I want to talk about doing what one can in the area that I know a little bit about from personal practice over many years, as well as professionally, more from the outside in, as a neuropsychologist, especially interested in what could be called evolutionary neuropsychology, really taking the mind-body connection seriously and realizing that in addition to the personal practices of mindfulness of the body, which are perfectly appropriate, the truth is we are body full of mind, that this hearing in this moment, the seeing in this moment, the sensing in this moment, the wanting in this moment, the fearing in this moment, the longing, the suffering, the loving, and all the rest of it is largely, if not entirely, constructed, conditioned, and constrained by underlying physical factors and processes that have themselves been shaped by 600 million years of evolution of the nervous system laid on top of roughly another 3 billion or so years of the evolution of life altogether on this planet. So I'm going to embed what I'm talking about here inside that frame. Okay, so then if we are coping with life, whether it's dealing with issues at a very intimate personal level, raising a child. I have friends who are raising kids of all ages. Ours are 29 and 26 right now, and we're still involved in that process. Dealing with a health issue, grappling with a leaky faucet that you keep driving you crazy, you can't sleep. Or issues scaled up at the level of the community, needing a stop sign next to a school, or scaled further to healthcare system or late stage capitalism or culture altogether, right? In terms of dealing with issues at those different scales, at the level of the person, because that's the level of intervention I'm going to focus on here. Not at the level of public policy, which is incredibly important. You know, I'm a rank amateur in that regard, but I do know a little bit about intervening at the level of the mind and the body. And so in terms of intervening at that level, I think there are three fundamental things you can do, basically, and that'll be kind of a framework here. When things happen, first of all, we can simply be with them. There are three great ways to engage the mind skillfully and productively, in my view. First, we just be with what's there. We experience the experience. We feel the feelings. We let be. We hopefully be with what's there in a space of awareness, being mindful about it, stepping back from what's there, not overwhelmed by it or flooded by it, kind of like getting out of the movie screen and stepping back 20 rows and going, whoa, that's intense, you know, up on the movie screen of your experience, right? It can often help to tease apart the elements of experience, to sense down even to what's younger or more vulnerable or more fundamental, like the hurt that's often anger, often underneath anger, for example. And in the process of just being with experience, just being with it, and being strong enough and brave enough, courageous enough, in other words, to be with experience. Sometimes it changes. Sometimes it changes for the better, let's say. But you're not directly trying to intervene in it. You're not engaging any kind of wise effort in your mind. Okay? That's the first great way to practice, letting be. And I think in terms of events in anyone's life, and certainly the events of the last 2 days and the last 2 years and all the rest of that, there could be many reactions in the body, you know, sadness, alarm, delight, fear, concern, shock, many, many different experiences there. The mind can start twirling, all kinds of thoughts start spinning. There can be an intensity of reactions. Can we simply be with what's there without being flooded by it or acting it out, particularly in a way that harms ourselves and others? All right. The second great way to practice is to let go. It's to release, to let tension flow out of the body, to exhale, to let the feelings flow, to release beliefs that are not true or catastrophizing or harming oneself and others, to abandon problematic desires, to let go of motivations or plans or intentions or aims or addictions or cravings that are just not good for us or good for other people. That's the second great way to practice. We release, right? We let go. And then the third great way to practice is to let in. It's to actually take in the good or grow the good, to cultivate, to grow resources of various kinds inside ourselves. In other words, to develop secure attachment over time. Even if we had, as I did, a C-minus or worse childhood, rocky childhood. You grow mindfulness. You grow compassion for yourself and other people. You grow grit, determination, commitment to justice, commitment to social change, say, commitment to sobriety, insight into yourself or other people, growing gratitude, growing happiness. If the big drug companies could patent happiness based on its already research-proven benefits for physical health and longevity, we'd be seeing ads for happiness on television every night in primetime TV. So whatever the good is to grow inside ourselves, that's the third great way to practice. So we have essentially, first, let be. Second, let go. Third, let in. Three great ways to practice. It's not either or, again. I think letting be is the mother of them all. It's the fundamental. It's the foundation. It's their last resort, because often we just can't let go or let in. We need to ride out the storm. We need to feel it. We're shocked. Something terrible has happened. We're worried sick. We're flooded. The best we can do is just be with what's there. And also, too, as you know, the kind of lifespan trajectory of personal practice continues, very often what you see, and I see it in my own teachers, is a growing restedness in simply being with what's there at the front edge of now, with insight and taking appropriate action, but mostly just abiding with whatever is the case. Okay. But just being with what's there, in my view, is not enough, and it can be overvalued sometimes and take people to a kind of inertness, a bare witnessing, and nothing but that with regard to themselves and the outer world. I think there's also a place for letting go and letting in. In a way, if the mind were like a garden, right, we can witness it. That's the first great way to practice. Or we can pull weeds in the mind, right, letting go. Or we can plant flowers, right? And all three work together, because to be able, for example, to just be with our own hurt or sorrow or rage or fieriness or fierceness or incredible arousal in our own body, let's say, or whatever is there, or a sense of paralysis or the reactivation of childhood trauma, to be able to simply just be with it, not swept away by the flood, to at least hold on to that 1% of you that knows what's true, and to kind of stabilize there, even though 99% of you is unbelievably freaked out. And I can speak from personal experience here in different kinds of situations I've been in this life. To be able to do that, you need to grow resources. You need to grow flowers inside the garden of the mind-brain system to simply be able to witness it without being swept away with it. So otherwise, opening to one's experience can be like opening a trapdoor to hell. All right. So how do we grow, let's say, courage, which is going to be our focus tonight, if that's okay. And by courage, I really am talking about fundamentally the root of the word in the French, I won't pronounce it properly, coeur or something, the heart. In other words, how do we have heart? How do we have a strong heart? How do we maintain an open heart, a warm heart for others, for life altogether, let's say, and certainly for ourselves? How do we actually do that? So I want to offer a few reflections about the process, actually, of growing the good in terms of the underlying neuropsychology of this body. How do you grow the good in this body? And so with regard to that, with regard to growing, for example, a steadiness that is a supporting factor of courage, or resilience, the capacity to bounce back fairly quickly, or determination, or warm-heartedness, or a capacity to hold strong and not be cowed or bowed by those who would try to confuse or frighten us. And I'll say a little bit more about that as I wrap up and move into the discussion portion of the evening. To grow the good inside us, we really are talking about, to put it a little technically, the movement from states to traits. So if you think about it from the standpoint of psychology and beneficial traits inside people, mindfulness, courage, compassion, emotional balance, equanimity, secure attachment, fill in the blank, right? Confidence, feelings of worth, what have you. Roughly a third of the causes of beneficial traits are baked into your DNA, on average. For some people, a particular trait is more shaped by DNA or less shaped by it, more shaped by other factors. On average, it's roughly a third. People argue a bit about it. Is it 40% or 33%? You know the joke in psychology or statistics? If you need statistics to see if something is significant, it isn't very, right? So ballpark, okay, ish. That's a real technical term we use, ish. It's a third-ish. All right. That means that the other two-thirds of the causes of growing the good inside, beneficial traits of various kinds, are actually amenable to influence, including influence those things that shape the expression, the epigenetic expression of our personal DNA, all right? And so of those other two-thirds, it has to do with the effects of environment, child-rearing environments, social class, you know, systemic oppression of various kinds, good fortune, you know, events coming from the outside, let's say, good or bad, let's say helpful or hurtful, and then also what we do inside ourselves. All right? So these factors occur, and then we develop beneficial traits like courage in a process, in a word, of learning. Learning broadly, not memorizing the multiplication table or the state capital, but emotional learning, body learning, heart learning, social learning, attitudinal learning, motivational learning, spiritual learning, the learning that we really care about. Right? Becoming a happier, stronger, wiser, more loving, whatever it is you care for, better person altogether, right? How does that process happen? Of learning, of transformation. Because if there's any kind of learning, any kind of lasting change, it must involve some sort of lasting change of neural structure or function. Right? There may well be supernatural factors. There may well be transcendental factors outside of what's called in science the natural frame. Personally, I'm with Hamlet. I think there's stranger things than are dreamt of in all of our philosophies. I'm a transcendentalist. That said, I'm going to stay inside the natural frame here. Minimally, mainly, if not entirely, this process of strengths acquisition, development of the good inside ourselves, involves some kind of lasting change of neural structure or function networked with and participating with the body altogether. The immune system, the cardiovascular system, digestive system, gastrointestinal system, hormonal systems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are important, but certainly the final pathway of the movement of learning, the conversion of state to trait, runs right between our ears. So how do you do it? And I'm going to wrap up pretty quickly with the lecture phase of this evening. The fundamental process of learning involves turning experiences of one kind or another into a lasting change, moving from state to trait, from, let's say, activation, you have the experience, to installation, or to say the same thing, in terms of the brain as an, you know, like a recording device. We are large biological recording devices, all right? You get the song playing. You have the experience of heart, of love, of determination, of recognizing that what they're telling you is not true. I was going to use a different word there. Not true, right? You have the song playing. We don't have the technology like Neo in the Matrix where you jack in the cable to the back of the head, and suddenly you know Kung Fu or can fly a helicopter, right? We have to have the experience. You have to play the song in your mind before you, in order to record it. But as we have the song playing, we help it sink in. The crux of that, just to name it, is more than anything to stay with it 5, 10, 20 seconds in a row. There's a famous saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together wire together. Right? It's kind of mechanical, deep down in the basement, basically. The longer we're sustaining a beneficial experience of whatever, openness, determination, calming, relaxation, feeling strong, whatever that is, the longer we stay with that experience, the more those neurons keep firing, the more they keep wiring. The more we open to an experience in our body, the more neuronal systems that are active, the more we come into our own body, move into an intimacy with lived experience, you know, in our own bodies, right here and now. As my friend Samuel Bonder puts it, we wake down, not just wake up. We come down into our own bodies. The more we do that, the more there will be a neural trace. The more that we can feel into the re- the reward of the experience, how it might be good for us or others, how it could feel actually good to feel strong or to be calming or to feel connected with others, you know, while being upset about something. The more that we can feel the goodness in the experience, the value in the experience, the more the neuronal systems involving neurotransmitters like dopamine or norepinephrine or other neurochemicals that flag keepers, right? The more that we feel rewarded by it, the more it's going to be internalized in general. And that, to finish up here, gives us an extraordinary power at a time when so many people feel pretty powerless or less than powerful, at a time when many people feel, me included, quite pushed around by external events, outnumbered, outgunned, if you will, in many kinds of ways. It's profound, I think, to know that in terms of the essence, actually, of good old-fashioned self-reliance, we always have the power inside the sanctuary, inside the sacred ground of our own mind. We have the power over where we rest our attention fundamentally and what we do with what we rest it upon, right? And can we rest it upon what's beneficial for us and others, keep it there, and then take that into ourselves? Or do we allow others to grab our attention, drag it in all kinds of different ways, and alarm us in the process? And to be crystal clear, I don't believe in positive thinking. I don't believe in looking at the world through rose-colored glasses. I want to see what's actually the case with a brain that's been designed by evolution with a negativity bias. Or as I put it, it's like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. We're designed to overlearn from painful, upsetting, frightening experiences to help us live to see the sunrise in conditions that were really harsh and intense. And we're designed to, relatively speaking, underlearn from beneficial experiences. Even though learning from beneficial experiences, turning those states to traits, is the way you grow inner strengths inside, including courage. So for me, it's kind of recognizing that life is difficult for all of us some of the time, and for many people, most if not all of the time. And second, in terms of developing strengths inside to deal with those challenges in life, we have a kind of well-intended universal learning disability inside us, this negativity bias that's like a bottleneck in the brain, the result of having a brain that's designed for peak performance in Stone Age conditions, right? And so as a result of all that, if you realize that Mother Nature is tilted towards survival but against quality of life, and if we tilt toward what is beneficial and authentic, not ever turning away from what's problematic, but if we also include those tiles in the mosaic of reality that are truly wholesome or beneficial or true or we can take refuge in, if we tilt toward those, we just level the playing field. Okay. So in a moment, I invite you to bring forward questions, comments. You know, we'll try to focus here at the level of personal practice. What can we do individually? If there are, you know, things having to do with public policy, I mean, I'll probably let those pitches go by. You know, at the end of the day, it's not either or, obviously. But what we can do is take in the good and cultivate what's beneficial inside ourselves for our own sake, as well as for the sake of other people. Because in a funny way, the more that a person's life sucks, the more challenging it is, the harder it is, or the more they're motivated to deal with terrible things out there in the world of any kind, at any scale. You know, so the more that a person is dealing with those kinds of things, the more important it is to grow strengths inside. And the fundamental neuropsychological process, the yellow brick road, as it were, to growing strengths inside, is to have beneficial experiences of those strengths, whatever you're trying to acquire, and then really help them half a dozen seconds at a time, maybe a few dozen seconds at a time, at least a handful of times every day, help them sink in to become a part of you so that more and more you have them with you reliably wherever you go. Okay. So hopefully that wasn't too much. We're okay. Thank you for that. All right. All right. So, hey, there's a lot of wisdom in the room. There's no monopoly up here. What are your comments or suggestions so far?
Okay. Anne. It seems that the first one is, by the way, it seems that much of our lives revolve around communication methods that go against letting go, letting be, and letting in. What suggestions do you have to better manage our interaction with others?
Oh, thank you. If I got the question right, and I may not, the first thing that strikes me is to be very attentive to other people who are trying to control our attention. William James, the godfather of psychology in America, about 100 years ago, wrote, "The education of attention would be the education par excellence." And that's because in terms of who we become, you know, the old line, you are what you eat. Well, that's true to some extent, but the modern update would be you are what you pay attention to, because neurons that fire together, wire together throughout the nervous system, but that process is turbocharged for whatever we are experiencing consciously, particularly what's in the focused field of attention. Attention is, in effect, a combination spotlight. It illuminates what it rests upon, and vacuum cleaner, sucking it right into our brain. And as social primates, social mammals, we are extremely vulnerable to people who try to compel attention with the classic appeals to fear and grievance, anger and payback. And whether it's clever marketers, I sometimes think the greatest minds of the 20th century or 21st century now are devising ever more clever advertisements, ever more clever pop-up ads, ever more clever ways to hijack our attention. You know, if there's any fundamental property, it's what we're attending to in this moment, right? They're trying to steal our property in a certain kind of sense. And also politically, you can see it throughout history. Not just in the last, few months or my lifetime, but really throughout human history, people tend to compel attention around fear. Because as animals in the wild whose prime directive was live to see the sunrise, eat lunch today, don't be lunch today, we are very, very, very vulnerable to appeals to fear. And some people are more vulnerable than others just due to temperament. Some are more born more anxious. I'm a little anxious in my temperament. It's a personal vulnerability that life happens, particularly trauma or growing up in really difficult situations. And then the person becomes particularly susceptible to the power of fear. So one of the takeaways for me is to be very aware of people who are trying to compel my attention and to ask myself, is this really for the greater good? For me to rest my attention there, to attend to that, to notice that, to stay with that, to concentrate on that, to focus on that. And also ask myself, what's the purpose? There's this classic Latin phrase, cui bono, who benefits? To what function is this, what is the function that's being attempted to be served by this compulsion of my attention, this grabbing, hijacking of attention? Or in the old line, follow the money. In other words, like, what's the point? So that's the first thing I would say. Be thoughtful about that. And then the other thing I would just say if I get all this, it's to come down to real communication with real people. I fear people have relationships often these days that are like a river a mile wide but an inch deep. Many, many people, but it's not grounded in a genuine intimacy. And again, just look at our history as a species, almost 200,000 years old, just like us, mostly sitting around the fire, looking at each other, touching each other, holding each other, being real with each other. And it's only in, the last 10,000 years or so that agriculture came in. Prior to that, we were hunter-gatherers, let alone our hominid ancestors, another 2 million years of toolmakers, roughly, prior to the emergence of the Homo sapiens, the human species. And really, it's only in the last 5,000 years that literacy came in and really mass communications in our close to our own lifetime, or maybe the lifetime of our parents and us. And so this is a radical change in how we evolved. And so I think coming down, particularly to real contact, real eyes, real touch, I think that's really real. That's the real information of the heart that, we can really take our stand in.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is A Courageous Brain, Not Manipulated by Needless Fear, with Dr. Rick Hansen, acclaimed neuropsychologist and best-selling author. His most recent book is Hardwiring Happiness, The New Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. One of our questions is actually two parts. What did you want to be when you were a little boy?
All right.
It's actually three parts.
Well, how little, right? That's actually, though, I'm going to take a swing at that in two ways, and I'll try to keep my responses pretty short to open it up as much as possible. The first is that I think a lot of people, when they go back to their earliest memories or earliest sense, you know, kind of in themselves, where you could say the youngest layers inside, there were things we knew when we were little that maybe we didn't have words for, but we saw the truth. We felt what was really going on, right? We saw through a lot of clouds. And one of the things that struck me when I was little, really embedded in my very earliest memories, is a sense that there's so much unnecessary unhappiness, so much unnecessary bickering, conflict, quarreling, tension, freak out, fear. You know, whether it's in my home or my neighborhood, the kids going to school, the grown-ups, what in the world are they doing? So the first thing I really wanted was deep inside, you know, when I was very young, was happiness. You know, I wanted to help people be happy. That was really central to me, quite young, really, and to kind of try to see clearly what in the world is really going on. Right, so that's a true answer. And I invite you to really reflect for yourself. What are those things you knew for sure were really true, that in retrospect, looking back, yep, they were really true about yourself, about other people, not based on lies people telling you that you internalized, like that you're a bad person, but knowing the actual truth that deep down in your core, you're a good person, a fundamentally good person, knowing that for yourself, that's true, or other things you might know that are true. That process of reclaiming for ourselves that we know in our heart of hearts are actually true, to me is profound and really deeply sacred. And then later, you know, reading a ton of science fiction, I, of course, wanted to be an astronomer, you know. And that passed when I realized that there were people who are a lot better at math than I was, you know. So I just kept on going. But that's, and here I am today.
Well, that feeds into the second part of the question is, when did you decide to be a neuropsychologist?
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, I've always been interested, maybe because this is not a scientific account, but I'm probably 40% Scorpio. All right, so probably more than you need to know. So I've always had this interest in getting to the heart of things. What's the bottom line? What's the deep cause? You know, what's at the root, right? So that drew me into developmental psychology initially. Great interest in children, you know, how are children, you know, developed. My dissertation was on 15-month-olds. You know, I have a deep interest in, you know, young children, some background there. But then along the way, you know, with this interest in deep causes, that took me into both contemplative practice. You know, there are many traditions in the world. The one that I know the best is the one that's probably got the closest link to science in the West today. That's Buddhism, particularly its earliest roots. And whoever they were across all traditions, including secular traditions of contemplative practice, these were the people who really brought an X-ray to the deepest, deepest layers of the mind. So that seemed pretty penetrating, all right? So we got psychology penetrating to the core, got brain science or contemplative practice, and then brain science. You know, the 3 pounds of tofu-like tissue right between the ears, containing roughly 1.1 trillion cells right now. The organ I'm talking about is trying to figure out the organ I'm talking about, right? That'll spin your head right around. You know, 10%, roughly a hundred billion of those cells are neurons. It's kind of where the main information processing activity is. A typical neuron makes on average about 5,000 connections with other neurons, giving us right now, inside the skulls of every single person in this room, a vast network of several hundred trillion little microprocessors. All those little synapses, all those little junctions, you know, sparkling away right now. I think Charles Sherrington called the enchanted loom, the brain continually weaving this moment of mind. So That's what took, you know, that's what got me interested in. I think just to leave it here on this final point, if you think about three circles, psychology, right, brain science, and contemplative wisdom, and where do those circles intersect? Imagine the intersection of three circles, right? Psychology, brain science, contemplative wisdom. Right at the intersection of those three circles, I think is a lot of really, really cool stuff. And as a psychologist, I'm a methods guy. I'm in the trenches. I think, you know, it's great to produce research. I only produce a teeny bit of research. Mostly I consume a ton of research and then think about how to apply it, right? So that's kind of what has gotten me interested. And I invite you into that territory yourself.
And this is the third part of the question is, do you think that many people, as they grow older, as adults, think about what they really wanted to be when they were kids?
I don't know. How many of you do think about what you wanted to be when you were kids? You know, for the radio audience, that's about, you know, a third or so of the room. For me, it's really about integration, being whole, you know, being a whole body, a whole person, including those younger layers. You know, this is the parfait theory of psychology, right? Different layers, right? Going down to the deepest, youngest layers inside and having a kind of inclusion of them. When I hit adulthood, I was numb from the neck down. I was totally out of touch with myself. And gradually, I needed to get in touch, which took courage. I think it takes courage to be with what's there, to bear your own suffering, to feel the feelings, or to risk the dreaded experience that might happen if you moved outside of your comfort zone. The process of risking the dreaded experience in wise ways, you know, deliberately well-chosen ways, taking small experiments, small chances to risk, what would it be like if I actually spoke from my heart? What would it be like if I asked this person for love? What would happen? What would it be like if I spoke truth to power? What would it be like if I changed my life in some important way? You know, we tend to live small because as we grow up, the brain learns over time, whoa, that hurts. You know, if I do that myself, or I watch my big brother do that, or I imagine that it could go badly like that, then I say, nope, I'm not going to risk that dreaded experience. Burp, 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 burp. And we play smaller and smaller and smaller, and we live lives. I've lived my life in some ways inside the bars of an invisible cage. And the art of growth is to understand what that dreaded experience might be, and then artfully, not foolishly, because you want to succeed at this, right? You want to help yourself along the way. Risk that dreaded experience, and when it goes well, which it usually does, because you're no longer living with the people you grew up with, you know, or you can choose more wisely where you're going to take that experiment, take the chance of risking the dreaded experience. When it goes well, take in the good, register it. Let that positive experience, that beneficial experience, pragmatically beneficial experience, help disconfirm those old beliefs that you have to play small, even though today it makes your life feel like you're walking around in a suit of armor that's three sizes too small, right? It takes courage to do that. It takes courage to be with our own experience, just like it can take courage to let go of what's familiar, to let go of what's known. And it can take courage to actually let yourself be changed a little bit for the better, as you judge what the better is, by the new experiences that you take into yourself and you internalize.
Okay. This question is, once we open to our experience, what do we do with it? So let me repeat that for the radio audience. Once we open to our experience, what do we do with it?
Yeah. Well, I think mostly we be with it. It is what it is. We feel the feelings. We experience the experience. Okay. Often, though, what's happening is we're getting caught in some kind of loop. You know, one of the great evolutionary developments, there are really two probably great evolutionary developments in the last several million years in terms of the brain. One is the adaptation to group living, learning how to really function with other people, which often looked like, you know, cooperating with us and fearing, dehumanizing, and exploiting and attacking them, All right. And how do we work that out? In the heart are two wolves, goes the teaching story, one of love and one of hate. And everything depends on which one we feed each day. And those two wolves co-evolved in us and in our ancestors. And in most people, both are certainly present today. Both are certainly present for me today. So what can happen sometimes is we can get caught up in the other second great evolutionary development last several million years in terms of the evolution of the brain, which has tripled in volume in just the last several million years. So most of the build-out of the brain is related to these two things: adaptation to group living, broadly defined lots of ways, empathy, language, bonding, politics, gossip, the important things. And then there's the other thing, which is the development of the inner simulator, in which we can do mental time travel. We can replay the past again and again and again, and we can imagine many different possible futures. And the reason I'm tapping the midline of my head is that's roughly where the circuitry of this inner simulator lives. The frontal regions are more task-oriented. The rear portions, kind of spreading out, are more of the default mode network, is where we go when we're kind of daydreaming and ruminating and so on. Studies show that on average, roughly 50% of the time, people's minds are wandering. And when they're wandering, more often than not, they're being drawn to a negatively tinged theme. A fear, an anger, a rehashing of a conversation, a resentment, a worry, a sorrow, a hurt, etc. So helping oneself become more aware, is my experience beneficial for me, or am I just running one more lap around the track in hell, digging it a little deeper each time I go around? Because when you're in the simulator, neurons are firing. And when neurons are firing, they're tending to wire as well. So pulling out of anxious rumination, resentful rumination, helpless, hurt rumination is really, really useful. And I ask myself, is this useful right now? You know, am I learning anything from this experience, or is it kind of same old, same old? And I'm just looping. I'm just doing laps around the track in hell. So that's another thing to do while we're having experience. And then, you know, I'm a very practical guy. You know, at the bottom line, I'm interested in, okay, what am I going to do? What's the action to take? Turn off the TV, call a friend, calm down inside, send some money to somebody, you know, write something. I've written a fair amount about politics recently, you know, which is a step for me to take. We do what we do, right? We do what we do. So it's not just about inner practice, right? It's about taking action as well. But the two to go together, because as, to kind of hit a theme that I think is really, really important, as we move out of living in small bands, roughly, you know, 50 to 100 or so people, you know, adults, roughly 40 to 50 adults-ish ballpark in a band. As we live together now, 7 pushing toward 8 billion of us here in a very vulnerable, you know, lifeboat, planet Earth, the kinds of ancient tendencies that made sense back in the Serengeti in terms of raw survival and living to see the sunrise are a prescription for disaster today. And much as in the old days, it made sense to just gorge on sweets. In other words, if you found something sweet as a hunter-gatherer, you should eat it, right? Because you can't store it. The best place to store it basically is in your body. And if you don't eat it, somebody else will, right? So we're really vulnerable to the appeal of sugar and carbohydrates today. And we didn't understand that appeal for a while. You know, I think in 1830, the average American ate about 15 pounds of sugar a year on average. Now the average is over 160 pounds per person per year, right? And you can see the results in obesity, you know, type 2 diabetes and the rest of that. And that issue you see worldwide. So it helps to understand the appeal of carbohydrates and sweets, you know, like hit that Stone Age brain, all right, and you want to go down the Hostess Twinkie aisle, you know, the supermarket, right? Oh, just one more cookie or, you know, whatever it is. That'll be okay. In the same way, we are really vulnerable as social primates, as I said earlier, to feeling afraid, to feeling threatened by them, you know, feeding that wolf of hate, holding tighter to us and dehumanizing them. And to me, when we recognize that that's what's happening, happening. You know, that little siren song is singing. A worm tongue's voice from the Lord of the Rings is whispering away in our head, be afraid, be very afraid. It's payback time, right? Recognize the power of that. And my suggestion is, with respect, and it's my personal practice as well, to pull out of that as fast as I can and stop reinforcing it.
Please comment on the validity of the use of SSRI meds to address anxiety, depression, and fear, and I think it's OCD.
Sure. Okay, so I'm a psychologist, and I'm a software guy, and so I respect their professional boundaries. I don't prescribe medication. That said, as a psychologist, I can certainly comment about physiological interventions of various kinds. There's a range of physiological interventions. Probably the two primary and most consequential, on average, physiological interventions are, number one, diet, and number two, activity, right? So, you know, make sure we work those, obviously. On that framework, I wear contact lenses. If I have a headache, you know, Advil's my friend. A bunch of us were talking at a party, I remember this, 20, 30 years ago. If you were stuck on a desert island for the rest of your life, and you could have one drug, any drug for the rest of your life, caffeine, LSD, heroin, what would be your drug of choice? Whoop, my hand went up. Advil, ibuprofen, pain control, that's what I want. So people, there's a place for pragmatics. And I think that actually many people are really benefited from, in skillful ways, fiddling with the hardware, whatever that skillful means might be, including potentially a prescription medication. I've known numerous people who really could not have lasting traction from their beneficial experiences because the underlying physiology and their own neurochemistry was just wonky. And it was a real step for them to realize, skillful means for me is to do this thing. Okay, that's great. That said, in addition to whatever we do physiologically, the opportunity for working with the mind, with becoming more aware of ourselves and more skillful inside ourselves, I think there are tremendous opportunities there, whatever might be beneficial, in terms of physiological interventions. Okay.
When you are working with clients who disassociate frequently, for example, someone who had trauma to inadequate care in early childhood, yeah. How do you help them hold on to the 1% of their selves when the 99% of them are running away from the saber-toothed tiger?
Yeah, that could be taken as a very specialized question, and I actually think it's a profound question that opens into some deep stuff. So if you'll bear with me, I'd like to offer a fundamental kind of framework here as a way of speaking to this in terms of particularly developing some high-impact inner resources. Okay. So the framework is fundamentally, like every animal, we have three basic needs: safety, satisfaction, and connection. Those are umbrella terms. A lot fits under the heading of each one of those three: safety, satisfaction, connection. I think there's some important needs. Many needs are blends. There's some important needs that don't neatly fit into that framework, okay? But it's a classic framework, and it relates to three fundamental motivational systems in us as well as in other non-human animals in which we manage these needs by, in order, getting safety through avoiding harms, fulfilling, having satisfaction through approaching rewards, and meeting our needs for connection through attaching to others. Okay? Avoiding, approaching, attaching, safety, satisfaction, connection, particularly linked to, loosely, the three layers of the evolution of the brain from the bottom up: the reptilian brainstem, the mammalian subcortex, and the primate human cortex. To simplify a lot of stuff, each of us has inside an ancient zoo, or to simplify, and I feel it myself, inside a little inner lizard, mouse, and monkey. Okay, so that's the list framework. So then the question is, how do we go about meeting our needs? And whether it's a human being or a mouse or a lizard, a zebra, what have you, basically, particularly more developed animals with nervous systems have two basic settings. On the one hand, when we feel like our needs are basically met, we, like other animals, default to our resting state, our kind of homeostatic, sustainable equilibrium condition in which the body repairs and refuels itself, conserves resources, recovers from bursts of stress or danger, and in terms of the mind, particularly more sophisticated animals, including us, you know, the mind is colored in three simple words in terms of safety, satisfaction, connection, with a sense of peace, contentment, and love. Other things could be going on, but in the core, there's that sense of calm, strength, or peace. There's a sense of contentment, gratitude, fullness already in terms of satisfaction, and a sense of feeling cared about and feeling caring already. When we're in our resting state, that is our home base. And that's the equilibrium state of our dynamic systems. But as you've probably noticed, we have another setting, right? I and other people have called this first one the responsive setting or responsive mode, or to simply put it, the green zone, all right? But then there's the red zone. That's where we go when we move into fight, flight, freeze, right? If we manage our needs in a sense of jeopardy, or we don't feel like our needs are being met. So we fire up, we burn resources, disturb our systems, get into intense conflicts with others. Sometimes we may need to do that to get our kids out of the house. There was a situation once where it looked like our apartment building was going to burn down. I raced into the house. We had a one-year-old, or actually about a two-year-old child at that point, our son, and I immediately ran into the house to get the things I most needed, shoes. I was barefoot at the time, my car keys, the discs for my doctoral dissertation, and my son's teddy bear. That was what really mattered, and I was in and out. Okay, I went red. I don't care. I fired up to do it. There's a place for the reactive mode, but Mother Nature's plan is to spend as little time as possible in the red zone because it's bad for us long term. Stress hormones, disturbing our systems, creating issues with other people, having a mind colored in three words with fear, frustration, and heartache in terms of safety, satisfaction, and connection is not really good for us and other people. The problem is most people today, or at least many people today, live chronically in the pink zone. Mild to moderate stress, upset, irritation, being frazzled. I definitely went into the pink zone, driving in traffic to get here for this evening, you know. And I've been doing these kind of practices for a long time, right? It's really easy to go there. Okay, so you see that framework? Basically, three needs, safety, satisfaction, connection, two fundamental ways, they blur together, but basic ways to deal with those needs, call it the green zone or the red zone. And in my view, particularly one fundamental practice that can help us deal with the world increasingly from a green zone place, even when the world is flashing red, which is to cultivate and grow strengths of various kinds, inner resources of various kinds inside us, so that we can, as we see in other people, like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., or Aung San Suu Kyi, or other people in life today that you may know well yourself, somehow they seem able to deal with real challenges while maintaining a kind of inner stability inside. They're not fighting their feelings, they're not denying difficulty, they're meeting things with strength, maybe being fiery if they need to be, but they're not swept away, as it were, by the dark side of the force, all right? And so people like that have a kind of deep inner keel in their personal sailboat. The winds of life can blow, don't knock them over, and if they do, they recover more rapidly. And we can grow that keel. We can deepen our personal keel so we stay more stably in this place of calm strength, feeling already full, already connected by repeatedly turning responsive mode, green zone experiences into lasting change inside. To summarize, look for every opportunity to pet the lizard, feed the mouse, and hug the monkey. All right. So that's kind of a frame. So in terms of that, now back to dissociation, trauma, and the rest of that, trauma is a training in the red zone. You know, it drags a person into the red zone, and we're very vulnerable. Remember the negativity bias? Like Velcro for bad, Teflon for good. We're really vulnerable to getting stuck there. All right. Maybe that's a way to survive a childhood or a combat tour or being in a life maybe that's like a combat zone here and now. Okay. But the real question is that useful today? Is that true today? Is that necessary today, that way of being? That takes me then to some very fundamental and accessible green zone experiences. For one, when it's true, notice in this moment that your body is basically all right right now. Most of the information coming into the brain originates inside the body. It needs to know that your heart is beating. So if your heart is still beating, please raise your hand if it's not, because we better call 911. You know, if your heart is still beating, if breathing is still going, it may not be a perfect moment. We're not always all right, right? We could be in terrible pain. Something could have happened that's unbelievably shocking. We're dealing with an emergency. Never lie to oneself, for sure. But most seconds, most nows of most lives, we're basically all right. It's not a perfect moment, but registering we're basically all right is a fundamental opportunity for calming and centering. So that even if a person starts to dissociate, hold on. I am breathing. This heart is beating. Living ongoing. Now. May not be all right in the next future, may not have been all right in the past, and now I'm actually all right. And now, continuously, and now, because it's true when it's authentic and true. That's a fundamental opportunity for people. Second fundamental opportunity is social support. Hug that monkey. You know, if the first thing we need to do when we're scared is, you know, come home to mama, come home to secure base, whatever that might be. It's to find that secure base. Perhaps that secure base is with the divine, the transcendental, you know, some connection there. Maybe that secure base is bringing up the memory of someone that you know has loved you or that you've loved yourself. Or maybe it's a friend or a comrade, some person who you have fellowship with or you're joined with in common cause. You know that's true. Even if you don't know their name or their face, you know they're with you right now in what you care about and what you're trying to do. You know, social support is profoundly important for us. And then the last of the three kind of quick go-tos, it's not the entirety of practice, but they're absolutely biologically grounded go-tos. Noticing you're all right now when you are, social support, some form of connection, including the expression of love. Love is love, whether it's flowing in or flowing out. And even if we can't get them to love us, they can never defeat our own love in one form or another, which certainly does not mean being walking on eggshells or being a marshmallow or anything like that. Then the third great practice, which goes to the satisfaction system, wholesome pleasure. You know, a very fast way for non-human animals in the wild to come out of a red zone spike of stress is to eat something or to feel some kind of wholesome pleasure. You know, be a little careful, right? You know what I mean? With what you do there, but hey, eat that cookie. You know, come on. You know, drink that water when you're thirsty. Feel that comforting cloth against your cheek. See something beautiful. Imagine something beautiful. Let yourself have a little pleasure. You know, turn whatever, you know, splash some water, touch something that feels good. Look at that blade of grass going up through the, you know, crack in the sidewalk, itself continuing to speak truth to power in its own way. You know, wholesome pleasure. And then when you have those experiences, don't waste them on your brain. Help them sink in. We've got a brain that's very spongy for the crud, but not very receptive to what's beneficial. When something good is there, you know, at the banquet table of life, bring a big spoon. All right. Other comments or questions?
I want you to know that I'm headed out now for a chocolate fudge sundae.
Exactly. With the power invested in me by the Board of Psychology of California, wholesome pleasure is a wonderful way to come out of red back down to rest in green.
And I know exactly where to go for the sundae, believe me. How do you build and train your focus and courage in a world of overstimulation and noise?
Well, I think one is, if a person can, I just offer this for you to think about. is to have at least a minute or more a day that you take for yourself and you do what is for you, some form of personal practice. It could be walking the dog. It could be handwork, knitting, art, craft. It could be a prayer. It could be a moment of gratitude at a meal. It could be the last reflection you always go through just before you fall asleep. Whatever that is, 1 minute or more a day in which you create an inner sanctuary. You say, this is sacred ground. I will protect this. This matters to me. I will not let you invade it. You may have my body. You may have my White House. You will never get my mind. And then in that sacred ground, do whatever is rewarding for you. What's alive, what's vital, what's not, you know, what doesn't become dry and mechanistic, what really feeds you. I think that's fundamental. And in there, usually there's a silence to it, right? There's a spaciousness. I think John Coltrane had this line, the music is the silence between the notes. I think I'm misquoting the source of that. But anyway, silent music is the silence between the notes, or, you know, and I think that we need to have that silence at least then a minute or more a day. That can become a very great sanctuary. And then in general, for me at least, it's to watch that addiction to TV, the news, my Facebook feed, you know, whatever, and disengage from all of that. And claim for ourselves our own ground, particularly in the face of lots and lots of people who, one way or another, are trying to take it from us.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is A Courageous Brain, not Manipulated by Needless Fear, with Dr. Rick Hansen, acclaimed neuropsychologist and best-selling author. Unfortunately, we've come to that point in our program tonight where we have one last question, and it's really an interesting question, so I want to make sure that I get it correctly. The program that you have tonight mentions A Courageous Brain and Needless Fear. Your book mentions Hardwiring Happiness, Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. How do you put those two together, and what is your thinking about both of those parallel concepts, or are they parallel?
Well, that's great. I'll speak to my experience doing a lot of rock climbing. So, you know, as a geeky kid, I was very young going through school. So I was picked last routinely for baseball in the fourth grade. And I finally discovered, you know, as I moved into adulthood that I was, you know, reasonably physical, and I was drawn to rock climbing. So I've been in many, many situations that were objectively hazardous. You know, standing on little edges, the width of a pencil or the width of a quarter on its side, you know, plastered against a rock wall. You need to keep moving up, otherwise you start sliding down or other things like that. And yet, even though it was very hazardous, even though there was some anxiety there, you know, even though I was really scanning and really vigilant and really alert, I was having the time of my life. Just because things are scary or hard or difficult does not mean, if I can and I will quote the Buddha from 2,500 years ago, they need not invade the mind and remain. They may arise. They may be there. We may need to feel some fear or fieriness, or hurt, or loss. They can be there. But in our core, can we retain a growing and deepening sanctuary of calm strength and feeling already full and already connected, on the basis of which we meet the next moment of this life? Can we actually do that? And I think for me, that's a way of describing or reverse engineering awakened mind, or what seems to be the lived example of the great reformers in history, the great teachers in history. How do they actually do that? So that goes then to that practice I described earlier. A handful of times a day, and this is probably a good way to finish up the evening, a handful of times a day, at least, usually less than 30 seconds at a time, usually half a breath worth or a few breaths worth, a handful of times every day, recognizing beneficial experiences when they're happening, or doing small, authentic, skillful things to help them come into being, calling up some gratitude perhaps, calling up some determination, calling up maybe some perspective, taking a wider, larger, longer view around current events, whatever it might be. We're now having that beneficial experience. At least a handful of times every day, help it sink in. Help it become your own personal property, in some sense of that word. Help those seeds of the flowers in the garden of the mind actually land and sink in, and then water and fertilize them so they grow inside you more and more and more. And I'm speaking personally as well. Grow inside all of us more and more and more. Then we can deal with those challenges of life on the basis of an underlying, those three words from my book, calm in terms of peace, or an underlying sense of contentment in terms of our need for satisfaction, or an underlying sense of confidence, which means with faith, or in fundamentally it means with courage, with heart, feeling already connected to all beings. And I love the fact that that's the opportunity that we all have. You can't do anything about the past, right? They say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. What's the most important minute of our life? I think it's the next one, the one right in front of our nose. That's the one we can do something about. What will we do with the most important minute of our life? At least a handful of times every day. Will we ignore what's actually authentically beneficial in our experience in that moment? Or at least a handful of times a day or more, will we help it land and sink in and take root for our own sake and the sake of all beings? Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is A Courageous Brain Not Manipulated by Needless Fear, with Dr. Rick Hansen, acclaimed neuropsychologist and best-selling author. His most recent book, Hardwiring Happiness, The New Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. A big thank you once again from the audience to Rick for being here tonight for this wonderful conversation. Thank you, Rick. Let's give him a great big hand. And many thanks to our wonderful audience here and on the radio and the internet. Find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on the website for programs and registrations. Click on Watch and Listen for Commonwealth Club videos, radio schedules, and subscriptions to our weekly free podcasts and program archives. And we also want to thank, before you leave tonight, the wonderful audience who has been here, and our audiences, by the way, that are on the radio and internet. Join us for our final fall programs, November 16th, a holiday toast to the 2016 wine harvest with wine tasting. Please join us that night. That's a fun night and very informative about how green our vineyards are. And December 1st, Resilience, a new documentary about children, hope, research, and the environment from the University of California, San Francisco, James Redford, director and producer. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you all for being with us tonight. Thank you to Rick. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you all.